Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
We are dispensing with our usual introduction because apparently it has triggered ads in foreign languages. So,
has it really?
Yes, we're getting some people, apparently, some folks, depending on what part of the country you're in, have been receiving Spanish language ads when I do my traditional introduction.
Really?
We'll just say, we'll give the redneck. Well, hey, we'll see if it comes out in redneck. Hey, 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 y'all, what's up? It's Bubba and Bugwe.
It's Bubba and it's my brother Daryl and my other brother Daryl.
My brother Daryl, my other brother Daryl. Yeah, well, hey, guys, well, welcome to Game of Crimes podcast. We'll see if it changes the algorithm. Hey guys, as always, welcome back. Just before we get started, just a little bit of quick housekeeping. Head on over to Apple, Spotify, hit those 5 stars. We've been getting a lot of good comments. People are leaving some stuff. Spotify allows you to give comments on the episode. Guys, we really appreciate that. Also, head on over to our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. We will have the book when we talk about our guests listed there as well too. Go to our book page. We've got some fabulous books coming out and some fabulous guests. So gameofcrimespodcast.com. Follow us on that thing they call social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. And also check out our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, who runs the Game of Crimes fan page with a, you know, iron fist and velvet glove. That's just right. Go to facebook.com and just put in Game of Crimes fans, and you will be just, hey, answer a couple quick questions, get admittance to the inner sanctum where all the good stuff happens. But you know where else good stuff happens, Murph?
Where is that?
Patreon.com/Game of Crimes. We've got some good stuff. I think we did a really good case of the month. We talked about the ambush killing of the deputy in Klinkenbrumer out in Los Angeles. And we talked about the escapee, which, by the way, Murph, so folks, they got to listen if you're not on there. But you were on the national news talking with Lawrence Jones about that.
I was, and it's a very short interview, so don't get excited. But we're talking about the fugitive in Pennsylvania, because since then, there's been two more in other states.
Yeah, well, and we give you our thoughts about that one, but it had to be short because it was late at night, and Murph usually is asleep by that time, so.
They don't know that I got my pajama bottoms on underneath my shirt I'm wearing.
I don't want to know. Hey, but guys, but that's where the fun stuff happens. But, and the other thing too, real quick, Murph, before we get into talking about one of our fun things, you will be appearing on CBS in a show.
You can't talk about it yet.
Oh, I can't talk about it yet?
I just got picked up last night for a second episode.
Well, then I will cut this part out.
No, it's okay. I just don't name the show yet.
Oh, don't name the show. So we can talk about it. We just can't talk about it.
It's not sure when it's going to be released. Originally, they were saying fall, but now they're saying late winter, early spring. So,
okay.
We'll see.
We won't say. Is it okay to say CBS?
You already did.
Well, we can edit this out. Is it okay to leave it in?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay.
If it's not, I'll hear about it.
I doubt that they listen to our podcast. But anyway.
Hey, well, I tell you what, the crew, you know, I gave them all business cards and they're like, oh, I'm going to listen to it tonight. So,
all righty. Yeah. Well, we won't say anything, but just suffice it to say is that you will, if things work out, we'll be seeing you on the telly.
It just shows you how hard they are for talent.
Boy, are they. Let's hope that this writer's strike resolves itself really soon in actors. Yeah.
Wait a minute. No, because as long as it's unscripted, I'm making money.
Yeah. Well, when they get to me and they're scraping the bottom of the barrel, that's when they'll solve the strike issue.
Thank you for mentioning.
Well, hey, no, it's good stuff because, we want to take credit for making you into the star that you're about to be. So you got your training here.
I think they felt sorry for the old hillbilly.
Speaking of feeling sorry for people, I'm going to tell you a story. But first, before we get into that, Murph, I have to ask you something.
Yes.
Well, I got to tell you something first. This is a show about crime. We talk about bad people doing bad things and bad people doing bad things to good people. We take the story seriously, but...
You know, we never take ourselves serious.
And what section of the show do we normally do, which we passed because two of the latest episodes dealt with 9/11 and the terrorist attack. So we, but we decided to bring it back. And so, so Murph, if we're going to talk about that, I have to ask you one question. And what is that question? Do you know what the question is?
What time is it?
What time is it? Do you know what time it is?
It's time for
Small Town Police Blotters. Hey, this one I stole from A.G. Harris IV. He posted it on the Game of Crimes fan group. Hopefully you haven't read this story yet, have you?
Probably not.
Okay. Not unless Connie read it to you. I get that. Okay,
she's been busy.
Well, Murphy... At first, this is going to sound like, what's the big deal here, right? So Indiana State Police Trooper was patrolling the area around Vincennes, Indiana, population 16,631.
Salute.
On Wednesday, this just happened recently. So during his patrol, they came across this guy, 51-year-old John McKee. He was driving a Jeep, right? Didn't seem like that was that big of a deal, but no lights, nothing. Pulled him over, right? So he pulled him over, showed signs of impairment. Arrested him, took him to the hospital. This is going to shock you, Murph. They found marijuana and meth in his system.
What's our number one rule?
Don't do meth, kids. Don't do meth. So he says, so they charge him with operating a vehicle while intoxicated with a prior conviction. So now here's the fun part, though. Now they release the dash cam and the body cam footage. And it shows him pulling this guy over. And after pulling this over, the trooper tells him, you know, you just can't drive these things down the road, right? So he conducts this test. That's when he fails him. They take him for a blood test. But this is where it gets really funny, Murph. Well, funny, I guess, right? No big deal that they arrested him in a Jeep, right?
Okay. What's wrong with the Jeep?
It's a Power Wheels Jeep. This dude is 51 years old in the middle of the night. Driving a Power Wheels down the street, no reflection, no lights, says he's going to go get gas for his other vehicle, but there's no gas can there. So while he has thoughts of stardom, he says, I've been riding these Power Wheels for the last 9 months, and you're the only one that's taken me to jail. He said he may get even famous for this, but I guess one of the funniest parts too, Murph, is remember when you would arrest somebody for DUI or something, you'd have to tow their vehicle? Funniest part was calling a tow truck out to tow the Power Wheels.
Was it his or did he steal it?
I think it was his. They didn't say they charged him with theft, but what got this started too? There's another little thread going on. Guy says, you ever arrested anybody on a John Deere and they're showing a little toy tractor? I said, well, yeah. Bex up, I arrested a guy in a John Deere 4450. Guy, Friday night driving down the highway, no lights in a big John Deere 4450. Remember his name too. It's like his 15th arrest for DUI.
Oh, holy cow. That's way past felony level there.
Well, they didn't have felonies back then. So it was just, misdemeanors on top of misdemeanors, but they changed that. So anyway, hey,
Wait a minute. What's a 4450?
It's a big one, like a quad.
Like a combine?
No, it's a tractor. So you can pull up. It's got power takeoff shaft on it. Good farming implement.
Got it.
John Deere Green. All right. Hey, Murph, this next guy did not want to go to jail.
Mm-hmm. Nobody ever does.
But this guy gets the award, I'm telling you, for not wanting to go to jail. So he was an armed robbery suspect. This happened up in Vermont, somewhere near Burlington. Again, this just happened recently. Eric Edson was wanted on accusations of robbery of a store in Burlington. Actually, back in August 24th, it just happened recently. And assaulting two police officers. So, and some stealing some stuff. So, what happened was the police responded to a man passed out in a running vehicle that matched the description of one used in a robbery a week prior, right? So when they roused him, guess what he did? He fled at a high rate of speed. He assaulted both officers with the vehicle. So now we've got a manhunt going on, right? So they find him. Guess what he did?
What he did?
He fled on foot. Then guess what he did?
Got caught?
No, he stole a bicycle.
Oh!
Then guess what he did?
What?
He stole a sailboat.
Really?
And while he's out on that sailboat, the Coast Guard goes to intercept him, and guess what he does?
Jumps in the water.
No, he hops in a kayak.
Oh my gosh, this is an episode where you can't make this shit up.
And then, so he up by the Lamoille River, I believe, in Georgia, Vermont, about 21 miles away from Burlington. He landed the kayak, ran away, and then jumped into the river and swam to the southern shore, where he was finally arrested by troopers and game wardens.
Oh, my God. I mean, think about a sailboat. You got to know how to run one of those things to even get it off the, you know, off. I mean, just to get it out in the water.
This is a guy that stole a car, fled on foot, stole a bicycle, stole a sailboat, stole a kayak, and then swam. This guy did not want to go to jail. And what happened, Murph?
He went to jail.
He went to jail. What's the old saying? If you run from police, you're just going to go to jail tired, son. So,
but you're right. He gets the award. That's the most I've ever
heard. I have never had anybody work that hard to avoid getting arrested.
Wow. Wow.
Well, hey. Well, speaking of somebody who's works hard, though, and this next one comes through you, somebody you used to work with. But I will tell you, if you talk about somebody who's done, you know, unlike our previous criminal who did, you know, various modes, here's somebody who served our country in Vietnam, DEA, TSA, and even doing contract work. As I was editing this, Murph, I got to just kind of goosebumps. It's like, what a hell of a story.
Yeah. And that's, and we're talking about Charles Lutz. And one of the interesting things about it is when I was a brand new DEA agent stationed in Miami, you know, my first level supervisor is a group supervisor. Your second level is called an assistant special agent in charge, or an ASAC. And Charles was my ASAC down in Miami. I had no idea he was involved in all this stuff. And once he left Miami, you know, you get caught up in your own career, and some people you don't keep up with. And I didn't realize he went and took over the Operation Snowcat program. And if you never heard of that or don't want to know what it is, well, just stay tuned, because you're going to find out. But his career is phenomenal. And I got to tell you, the best thing about this entire interview is at the very end. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but you don't want to miss it. It's the funniest thing out of the entire interview. I'm just going to drop it there, but you want to stick around. I promise you, you won't be disappointed.
Yeah, if you want Murphy's ego deflated, just hang on.
No. It's one of the funniest things, and I've even gotten a couple emails since then. But Charles has a book out. We'll talk about it during the interview. Unpopular Causes: A Career in Service to America, and that is one of the most appropriate titles I've ever heard in any of these books. A Career in Service to America.
Did you know something? And we didn't talk about this during the interview, and he sandbagged us. Did you know he won the Bronze Star?
No. He didn't even tell us that.
Got a picture of him getting a Bronze Star pinned on him in Vietnam.
Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, this is, you know what we call people heroes and patriots. This is one. This is an actual one who, even when he went to Vietnam, volunteered and went to Vietnam, and then volunteered to go in combat because he had a safe job and, you know, in the rear.
But he wanted to be in it.
And I guess that's where he got the Bronze Star.
That is. But there's only one way we're going to hear about this, Murph, and I have to ask you, are you ready to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes?
Yeah, people, you're not going to believe some of this stuff is getting ready to go on. So get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. Charles, tell us what a patriot's life is all about.
I'm not going to use my traditional greeting, Murph. I don't know if you've been catching up on the Facebook stuff, but every time I would use Spanish to introduce this, people were getting Spanish ads.
No kidding.
So I will say, let's try German, you know, guten Abend. Guten Abend, Frau. Herr, I said Frau. Guten Abend, Herr Murphy. You know, was ist los? You know, wo bist du? So we'll see if any German ads show up this time.
You know, my response to your German is bite me.
Bite me.
Do you understand that one?
Nine. I don't understand. So, hey, but anyway, look, guys, welcome back. We're going to dispense with the Spanish. Just see if it messes with the ads. And we have a special guest because this person has the dirt on Murph. He has come. He has decided to come clean. He is a whistleblower. He has filed protection under the Whistleblower Podcast Act. We have granted him whistleblower protection in order for him to tell the true story. So I'm going to let you take it from there.
Hey, everybody. This is, you know, most of you know about my background and my career in law enforcement. And when I first joined DEA, my first posting was Miami. I got there in 1987, late 87. And, you know, you go to your enforcement group, you meet your new supervisor, what we call a group supervisor, and then his boss is known as an assistant special agent in charge, or an ASAC. And I have the honor, Morgan and I have the honor of having my first ASAC and DEA on the show with us today, Charles Lutch. Charles, welcome, brother. It's good to see you here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on your podcast. And I have to say, when I first learned of it, I must have been living under a rock because it was just maybe 6 months ago. But since then, I've listened to a lot of your podcasts, and I have to say I'm very impressed.
He told us that he told me that Michelle Linhart was one of his favorite interviews. He found out things about her he didn't know.
She sandbagged us about where she grew up at, you know, and Go Bears, you know, and poofed her hair. If it had not been for poofing her hair, she never would have been on Baltimore PD and never would have been at DEA, you know.
You know, too, and I got to say this right up front, it's very unusual for me to call this man Charles because it was always Mr. Lutz or Hey Boss. So, you know, here in our twilight years, I guess, or the beginning of our twilight years, we've now become good friends.
Well, that's interesting. We've now become good friends. Maybe there's some adversarial stuff we can talk about. But as we do with everybody, Mr. Lutz, Charles, how did, you know, Cosa Nostra, thing of ours, how did you get started in this thing of ours? And don't tell me, I'm going to guess, based on your age, it wasn't Miami Vice. Miami Vice didn't come on the air until years later. So how did you get started in this thing of ours called law enforcement? You know, what was your journey to getting into DEA?
Well, actually, it kind of goes back to my Vietnam service. I was graduate at Penn State University, and I was commissioned an intelligence officer, which I guess is kind of an oxymoron.
Military intelligence, right? One of the great contradictions.
And I was sent to Vietnam. It turned out to be a very good experience for me. People ask me, you know, where'd I grow up? And oftentimes I'll say Vietnam. In college, I was only responsible for myself and hadn't done a particularly good job of that. And here in Vietnam, I had men asking me, what do I do now, Lieutenant? And I could tell you grew up real fast. But I also enjoy, it's hard for some people to realize or understand, but I really enjoyed my tour of duty over there. And I was, for 6 months, I was an advisor to a Vietnamese Infantry Division Intelligence Unit.
What year was that?
That would have been 1968 to 69. I was there, but more in the first 6 months of 1969.
Were you there during Tet?
I came in just after the Tet Offensive.
Okay.
And the month before had been the deadliest for Americans of the entire war. So I obviously was a little bit nervous landing there at Benoit Air Base. But in any event, I enjoyed the work that I did there. And when I started looking, and you know, kind of a childhood interest of mine was law enforcement. Although when I matriculated at Penn State, in those years, they didn't even have a law enforcement program. So I ended up a political science major thinking, well, maybe learning about government would help me someday.
If anybody can figure that out, man.
It doesn't really prepare you for the realities, does it?
No, it does not. But in any event, I was looking around at law enforcement agencies. Actually, I have to tell you the story. It's kind of funny because I just gotten out of the service. I was sitting in a barber shop in Philadelphia, my hometown, and my barber, who I'd known for years, was asking me, "Well, you know, now you got your college degree, Vietnam service, your military service out of the way, what are you going to do?" And I said, "Well, I'm thinking about getting into law enforcement." And as a guy sitting in a chair waiting his turn in the barber's chair, he says, "Excuse me," he said, I think you may be somebody we're looking for." And I looked at her, I said, "Well, who are you?" It turned out to be a group supervisor with the Narcotics Bureau in those days, the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. We used to call it the Bureau of Neurotics and Dangerous Drunks. And there's a lot of truth to that, I think. But,
and then it morphed into drunk every afternoon.
Right, exactly. And so in any event, he told me, you know, why don't you, you know, we're hiring, which was the magic word back in those days. And so I went down to the customs house, actually, where BNDD was located. And when they told me that 10% of their agents were stationed overseas, I thought, wow, this is exactly what I'd like to do, you know, kind of focus my law enforcement career internationally. So I went home, I told my mother. She said, you have to talk to your cousin Harry, who happened to be the deputy police commissioner in Philadelphia, who I really didn't know very well. But anyway, she made an appointment for me. I went down, and the first thing he said to me, he said, oh my God, don't get into narcotics, too much corruption. I think he was talking about New York.
That was Serpico.
The they're having up there. Yeah, this was 69 at that time. And yeah, exactly. And or maybe he had some corruption closer to home. I don't know. But in any event, his best friend was Secret Service. He called him on the phone. He said, hey, I got a guy, just the kind of person you're looking for. And he sent me over there. So this sack of Secret Service told me what that was all about. But on the way home, I thought, wow, this is unbelievable. I said, you know, I just went in for a haircut
and I got two job offers.
Exactly. I said, maybe if I go back for a shave, the FBI will want to give me an offer, you know. But,
thank God you didn't do that.
But, well, the FBI, they were hiring lawyers and accountants and so forth. So I knew that wasn't up my alley. Yeah. So the next day I went in, went back to BNDD and I said, hey, I'm your guy.
So, first of all, welcome home. My dad was a World War II and a Vietnam vet, so I know what it was like to have family over there and stuff. So, thank you for that. I assume it was Army is what you said, right?
Yes, correct.
That, which is the only branch to be in, by the way. Go Army, beat Navy. But what out of that, you went through Penn State, was it the ROTC program that you got your commission through?
Okay. Yes, it was.
Yeah, so when you were over there, were you kind of tell us about some of your assignments. Where were you stationed at over in Vietnam?
Well, my first 6 months, I was a Saigon warrior. I was assigned to staff jobs in Saigon, but kind of itching to get out into the field. I mean, call it naive on my part, but I had the training, the history of had been taught to me of the military, the great military officers that we've had in our nation, and I thought, you know, this is the only war I'm ever going to have, and if I'm going to prove to myself, you know, that I have the courage to do this, and I got to get out in the field. So one night I was in a bar in Saigon, and I'm with a couple of my buddies, and I probably had too much to drink, and I said, you know, if they had me out in the field, this war had been over years ago. And there's some guy again, says, hey, Lieutenant, he said, maybe I can help you. Oh yeah, well, who are you? Well, it turned out to be a sergeant at the Military Advisory Command, MACV, and he said, hey, I'll exchange you with the next guy that's coming in to go out to the field. I said, hey, you do that. I wrote on a bar napkin. I wrote my name and my unit, serial number and all that, and gave it to him. Forgot all about it. A couple weeks later, I get orders to go to a place called Swan Lock that I couldn't even pronounce. And I got my wish. I got out to the field. And I did get my taste of combat, and I survived it. So, I mentioned before, it was a very good experience for me.
Yeah. When I went through ROTC in college, but to join the advanced program, we went through basic training to begin with, join the reserves. Several of my drill instructors, my DIs, were Vietnam vets. They had the CIB, the combat infantry badge. They had been in the shit, you know, they'd been there. And just, you know, they rarely, the thing is, like my dad, that folks rarely talked about it. You know, it was a tough time.
Well, you know, my claim to fame, I guess you could say, is I used to run these what they call Firefly missions. And I would go up with in a Huey helicopter that had a searchlight on it, and overhead was flying one or two Cobra gunships.
So you were a bullet magnet is what you were, right?
Well, exactly. I used to sit on my helmet.
Helmet, sit on the steel pod, yeah.
Because I figured the only thing they could see from the ground was the light, and I'm sitting right next to it.
Ooh. Did you ever sit there and thinking, what the hell did I do when I asked for this move?
Now, a few times.
Yeah, I bet.
It reminds me of Chris Feistel and Dave Mitchell when we're talking to them about, you know, working down the Cali cartel, and they went out into the cane field to meet, you know, Jorge Salcedo. And it's like, what the hell were we thinking?
Yeah, I had a few of those moments.
Man. So, but the reason I asked you that, I wanted to ask you, how much of that prepared you for what you were about to do with BNDD and later? How many of those lessons did you pull out of that and were able to pull forward into the work that you ended up doing?
Well, I think, first of all, it was the self-confidence that came from surviving that situation, but also the discipline and, I think my military experience actually resulted in a lot of the assignments that I ended up getting throughout my career.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there was some leadership involved in there, some leadership lessons.
Well, I like to think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hey, you're a good leader. I'll vouch for you. I worked for you.
I was a good maker of leaders. I was the one that trained future leaders, because if they could deal with me, they could deal with anybody.
Isn't that the truth? Oh, my gosh. God bless those people that went through your class.
Hey, wait till you see who was in my academy class and how they survived. You get your haircut, you get a couple job offers. So Secret Service, BNDD, and you were talking about making that decision. Let's talk about that. Which one appealed to you and why?
Well, the BNDD was the overwhelming choice because of the overseas opportunity. I don't think there's any other federal agency, certainly not in that day, that had the presence overseas that BNDD, now DEA, has. And that was where I wanted my career to go.
You know, and I think it's still like that. I think DEA still has the largest footprint outside the United States of any federal law enforcement agency in the United States.
Including the Bureau and other LEGATs?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah,
like when I was in Colombia, there were two LEGATs. We had, I think back then we had 23 agents in Colombia. Now they do have the Resolution 6 agents down in Mexico, which is beefed up, and I'm sure they've beefed up some of their other posts, but DEA still has the largest footprint.
Wow. Well, we know they only needed two to fight the war on drugs in Colombia, you and JP. So
that's it. It's all over.
Of course, BNDD had a novel idea that you had to learn how to be a criminal investigator before you could go overseas, mm-hmm, and help foreign police be drug investigators. So I started out in Philadelphia, and the first opportunity I got, I applied for an overseas position.
So give us an example of kind of back in those days. What were the kind of cases you were working in Philly? Because, you know, we actually had Pete Charette on. We're talking about the French Connection. You know, we've talked about other folks. What kind of case, what was the main focus of BNDD, you know, in that, which I guess would now be the early 70s, right, is when you started?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, President Nixon had his, at least the media called it, his war on drugs. It was actually a heroin epidemic back in those days. And Philadelphia, that's what we targeted, was heroin. And, of course, undercover was essential. I guess it's, you know, they call drugs cases victimless crimes. Certainly, there are a lot of victims, but it's called that because not many drug dealers are going to call the cops on themselves, and the users certainly don't call the cops on their suppliers. Mm-hmm. So in narcotics work, at least in those days, now there's a lot of technology involved that we didn't have in those days. In our day, you worked undercover. In effect, you had the crook commit the crime in front of you and then complain to a jury that he broke the law.
No better evidence than having a law enforcement officer testifying to the facts.
But I have to say, I tried to do a lot of undercover work. I was not very successful initially.
Why?
Well, I guess some people are much better at it than others. It's like acting, and some people it just comes naturally, and others have to work at it. I had to work at it, and.
How many years have you acted like you like Murph? I mean, there's some good acting right there.
Yeah, he deserves a cameo. An Emmy.
Cameo. An Emmy for the cameo. Yeah.
There you go.
Well, I think, for one thing, most of the heroin dealers in Philadelphia were either black or Italian-American. And the most effective undercover agents – were of that tribe, you know, and as a German, English, Irish guy, you know, in those days, it was just very difficult to infiltrate into one of these organizations, have any credibility at all. Hmm.
So what changed for you then? When did you start getting over that hump and start making cases?
Well, actually, I'm kind of embarrassed to say that my first successful case was a marijuana case. Mm-hmm. You know, we called it kitty dope. Mm-hmm. None of us wanted to work marijuana cases. Real narcs worked heroin, methamphetamine, and later on cocaine. But I actually had 500, pounds of Mexican marijuana delivered to me in, of all places, Memphis, Tennessee. And that was my first success as an undercover agent.
Hey, you got to get your feet wet somehow, right?
Yeah, well, exactly.
Gives a new meaning to walking in Memphis 10 feet off a Beale. You know, smoke a little bit of that marijuana, you know, get high.
But later on, I have to boast a little bit. I had an informant that introduced me to a Colombian national who sold me the first kilogram of cocaine ever purchased undercover in Philadelphia. That kind of, again, built my confidence.
Yep. Just randomly, do you remember how much the kilo went for back then?
Yes, it was $3,000, which I thought was an incredible amount of money. Actually turned out to be pretty cheap. But at that time, I was making just slightly more than $6,000 a year.
Wow. Holy cow.
Not much has changed, right?
What year was that?
Well, that would have been probably 72, something like that. Wow. 73.
So I was a uniform cop in West Virginia. I started at $9,600 a year, and I thought that was pathetic. It was pathetic.
Dang. Yeah. Well, I started off at $7.25 an hour. What is ever that works out to? It's like $14,000 a year, I think. So, but $3,000 a year and you've got, or $6,000 a year and you've got dope in your hand worth three, which you could cut, right, and probably sell for, you know, 50 or 100, right?
Right. Exactly.
So, but as you go through BNDD, you were there when BNDD became DEA. When did that change happen into your career? How far were you into your career when that happened?
Well, in 1973, mm-hmm. I applied to go overseas, and I was selected to go to Thailand. I'm sure largely because of my experience in Vietnam.
And was that also because that was a source of supply for heroin?
At the time on the East Coast, yes. The Golden Triangle was the predominant source for heroin. And it was of interest to me to go over there. So anyway, I applied. I had been working undercover again on a case against some – he was really a mope, I have to say, but he had some connections to Italian organized crime in Philadelphia. And I made a couple of purchases. It was actually pills of some sort. And so we were following him, trying to find his source of supply, when I got notified that I'd been selected and had the report for Thai language school. So we had to take the case down.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 27th through July 7th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
And so we took this guy off and figured, you know, we had enough charges on him through the couple of buys I've made, we could prosecute him. Thought we might be able to flip him. And so at that day, we, of course, back in those days, we didn't have cell phones and things like that. The guy had a telephone book in his pocket. And in there, well I should back up a little bit. I guess at that time, BNDD, they had an undercover phone put in our apartment. And my wife used to answer it when I wasn't around, you know, to kind of make it seem like we were normal people. And when we took this guy down, he had my undercover name in his book and my phone number. And below that, he had written in my actual address. So apparently he had a connection with New Jersey Beltel. I was living right across the river from Philadelphia at the time. And they must have had a connection with New Jersey Beltel and got my real address. So, of course, the SAC in Philadelphia said, hey, you got to get out of there. My wife had just had a baby. But the timing was good in the sense that I was headed for language school anyway. So I left Joy, my wife, with her mother and went down to Thai language school. Well, it was while I was down there that Executive Order 1 created the Drug Enforcement Administration. The idea was to stop the bickering between Customs and BNDD. It didn't work. It didn't work because they never defined, in my view, they never defined the border. So without having done that, Customs, you know, DEA ended up with everything domestically and internationally. But because the border wasn't defined, Customs would stretch it down to, say, Colombia to bring back cocaine to the border. And then once they got it on the border, they would stretch it to the Midwest to deliver it to some guy and knock him off. So they were, you know, and so the bickering never ended.
To this day, it's still ongoing.
Yeah. But DEA was created. By that time, I have to say, I was a GS-11 agent, and GS-12 was the journeyman level. And I went to language school as an 11, and my supervisor, a guy named John Wilder, tremendous fella, he had the say as to whether I was going to be promoted or not. And I figured, well, that's not going to happen because he's going to give that to somebody who's working for him. You know, I'm leaving, I'm gone. Well, he promoted me, and that got me to Bangkok as a journeyman. And I happened to be end up being one of the senior agents in Bangkok when they came out with a senior position, you know, GS-13 level. So I got that. So here I am, you know, with barely, you know, 5-6 years on the job, and I'm a GS-13 senior agent. So that all worked out very well for me.
Now you're up to like $7,500 a year, right?
Yeah. Woo-hoo, we're rolling in the dough.
Yeah, exactly.
Charles, you mentioned a while ago the Golden Triangle. Can you tell our listeners what countries comprise that?
Well, it's northern Thailand, northern Laos, and basically the Shan state of Burma, which is now Myanmar.
Myanmar, yeah.
They, at that time, were producing the majority of the opium poppy in the world, from which the opium is extracted and then chemically transformed into morphine and then heroin.
Yeah. See, hey, where'd you go to through language school at? Where'd they send you to?
At the Foreign Institute of State Department in
Roslyn?
Roslyn, Virginia, yes.
Yeah.
Woohoo.
Woohoo. Yeah. A lot of good stuff goes through there.
Yeah. It was a good school.
Yeah.
When I went through Spanish school there, the guys that were learning to speak Thai, you remember Joe Reagan? I don't know if you remember him or not on the job.
I don't.
He was going through the Thai language school, and we were probably, Spanish was 6 months. I think his was 9 months. And we were probably at month 3 or 4. And he got excited one day because we're going on the train heading back to our apartments. And he's like, hey, I can finally say my name.
Well, it's true. You know, Thai was very difficult for a lot of us. And the problem is, that, first of all, there's no connection to
with English.
Romantic language with English or Spanish or whatever. And it's a tonal language, which is something that you grow up hearing, you know, the young Thai hears the tones and understands it. For example, the word ma, depending on the tone, means either come, doctor, or horse.
It's very much like Vietnamese. We had a big Vietnamese community when I was a trooper because of the beef plants and other stuff. And it was like one of the folks we worked with had basically fluent in Vietnamese, but it took him years. But to your point, yeah, one word, depending on the diphthong, the voice inflection, could mean 5-10 different things. All I remembered how to say was Bang Lai. And that was driver's license. That was the one phrase I figured out. So, but man, that's got to be tough. Like I said, it's not like, you know, like you say, if you knew Spanish, you could pick up some Italian, you know, or things like that, you know, vice versa. But that is so tough. So when you got out, you know, you go to Bangkok. So how's it taking the family over there? You know, new father, got kids, you know, heading over there. What's it like to go to your first foreign country?
Well, we went over there. My wife, we look back on it now. We say, how in the world could we have taken the first grandchild of either of our parents away from them, halfway around the world, to a place they probably never had heard of before? So it was difficult for my wife, but she never complained. And I have to say, I was just looking at my career, my future, you know, my ambitions. So I was oblivious to it. And our 9-month-old daughter, of course, she was just happy to get all the attention. Anyway, we get over to Bangkok. We're put in a beautiful luxury hotel suite. And in fact, our daughter took her first steps in the hallway at that hotel. But the first morning, okay, now this is after 9 months of Thai language training.
And about what year is this?
This would have been 1970, January 1974.
And the Vietnam War is still going on for like another year.
Well, it is, but
it's kind of winding down.
Combat
right?
Troops are have been pulled out by then. So anyway, I had to get to the American embassy, and I didn't want to take a embassy limo because it was expensive. So I figured, well, I'll just go out on the street and and flag down a taxi. So I go out, and first taxi comes along. I wave him down, rolls down a window, and I said in my best tie, "How much money to the American embassy?" "Paisatan tut America, tal right cop." He looks at me, he goes, "No speak English," rolls up the window and drives off. And I thought, 9 months of my life for nothing. I ended up walking to the embassy.
Oh, I was, man.
So anyway, obviously he was not expecting a Westerner to be speaking Thai. And obviously my Thai was not, you know, perfect.
You might have been asking for a ride or asking him for to stab you in the nose with the plastic fork. Hell, you don't know.
How much? I want to buy your daughter. How much is she?
Not for sale. Hey, so tell us, what was it like? You know, I mean, you were not that far. You were far away, but not that far away. You'd been over in Vietnam. Now you're kind of returning, kind of in the same area. What was it like working cases there now in Thailand? What was your work like?
Well, it was incredible. I mean, you could go to any cab driver in Bangkok and have them take you somewhere to buy a kilo of heroin. The heroin was selling for about $5,000 a kilo. It was we were just falling over cases. But in fact, the first case I worked on, my senior partner that I was assigned to is a guy named Bud Schoaf. And Bud had a case going at a hotel in Bangkok. He had an informant who there was a German lady and a fella from Washington State, Seattle, who were there to pick up heroin from Bud's informant. So they were in a hotel room in Bangkok. I went in and kind of ran the command center in another room in the hotel. And but it kind of turned everything I had learned in Philadelphia and in basic training on its head, because, you know, we were always taught you go for the source of supply. You work your way up. You buy some dope from a dealer. You try and flip him to get him to introduce you to his source, and flip that source to get up the next rung in the ladder. Well, in Bangkok, the whole idea wasn't to go after the source, because they were everywhere. The idea was to work it downstream. For example, these two people are there to buy heroin. Well, we wanted to find out who they were delivering it to in the States. So it kind of reversed the process.
Well, tell us about was it that the Thai government, how much of an interest did they have in stopping this, you know, or working on this? Because, look, there's some challenges even today when you think about, now they've come a long ways when we talk about things like sex tourism and a lot of the things that were going on in Bangkok and some of the other things. How invested were they in stopping this?
The government itself was not. It was, there was corruption. In fact, It's systemic in Thailand in those days, because it actually went back to the days, hundreds of years before, where kings would send their representatives out into the provinces, and the people who they governed were expected to care for them. Well, who could do that? Well, the merchants, basically. And so they got all the services. Well, by 1973, the most wealthy merchants were the drug dealers. So they got all the services, and the government was totally corrupted, except to say that there were a few very honest cops. And that was kind of our challenge, to find honest cops that we could work with. And we did.
How did you vet them?
We didn't. It was just the experience of working with them over time, and let me tell you how that evolved. Okay, as I said, the greatest challenge to me was finding honest cops to work with. I went back to Thailand. I'm getting way ahead of the story, but I went back to Thailand in charge of all of our Southeast Asian operations 20 years later. And I was amazed because one of the first things I did was go to a conference in Japan with other law enforcement agencies from around the region. And I'm sitting in a room and the Japanese, the South Koreans, the Malay, they're all, every time a question would come up, they would turn to the Thai and say, what would you do? What should we do? And I thought, this is truly amazing. And it's and an example of what can happen with, in this case, DEA, working hand in glove with these officers throughout their career. We were able to change the whole environment there to one of corruption to respect by other nations. It's amazing.
I know one country that wasn't at your conference, North Korea.
Well, that's true.
Or China.
Or China, yeah. Hey, well, so we'll get into that, but that kind of begs the question. I mean, you have been to many different places. Let's not get too far ahead, but let's talk about, just real quickly, kind of bookend it. How many different countries did you work in during your time with DEA?
Well, I lived in two overseas, but I worked in, I think one time I counted them all up, probably 52 countries that I actually worked in.
Wow. Well, and that's because when so you're stationed in one location, especially if you're the boss, you're responsible for multiple countries within that region, and it requires you to go there. You have to establish relationships with the head of the law enforcement agencies for the whole country. I mean, these are some very, very high level meetings that you're expected to initiate and cultivate.
Well, I lived in Thailand twice, a total of about almost 8 years. I was in the Middle East, and Joy, unbelievably, had our two young daughters by then with her, and I had acquired a regional responsibility. I had almost every country in the Middle East, and of course, in those days, Beirut was the center. I mean, not only was there a war going on, but they were the principal supplier of hashish and of heroin produced in the Middle East. So I spend most of my time in Beirut and these other countries, and my wife spent her time in Cairo raising our two daughters.
Yeah, we're going to give some special recognition to Joy at the end of this interview because she put up with all of our wives put up with a lot of crap.
True.
For what allows us to do our jobs.
So, what year were you over there in Egypt? When would you have been in? Because I'm thinking about, were you there during the time? I think it was 83 when they had the Marine Barracks bombing.
I was there. You're talking about Beirut.
Yeah. I mean, stationed at when you're in the Middle East, but when Beirut was under your, area of responsibility, were you there during the barracks bombing?
I was not. I was there in the Middle East from 79 to 81.
Oh, a couple years before had.
Yeah.
Okay.
But shortly after I got to Egypt, is when the Iranians took our Americans hostage in Tehran, and the Ayatollah was calling for all of the Muslims to rise up and slay the Americans. So this was not a great time to be living as an American in a Middle Eastern country. Although I learned later that, and we didn't know much about Islam. So we didn't know that, for example, the Egyptians are Sunni, I guess, and they do everything in Shia, and they don't agree on anything. So the fact that the Ayatollah is calling for Americans to be slain is not something that resonated with the Egyptians. We didn't know that at the time. It was very tense.
Did you have any issues with your personal security during that time over there because of that?
Well, I one funny incident, wasn't funny at the time, but of course, in our house, we lived in a community called Mahdi, which is a suburb of Cairo. And we had guards, locals, that, on our house. They weren't armed, but they were just there to, I guess, holler if so, you know, if something happened. But in any event, one night,
here comes 20 people with AK-47s. You're all going to die. Bye.
Run.
Well, one night, we're awakened by scuffling just outside of our bedroom window, and I get up and I pull the curtain, and here there's three or four men carrying our BOAB, our guard, down the street and around a corner. And I thought, oh my God, they're coming back for us next. So I called the embassy Marine security guard.
Everybody's always post one, aren't they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, they just carried my guard off. You got to send somebody out here, you know? So it took quite a while. Finally, one of the regional security officer's men showed up at the door, and he apologized for taking so long, but he said, I wanted to, you know, find out what was going on. And he told me, so he left and I sat my wife down. We had barricaded the house. We had, you know.
Hey, were you, you allowed to carry weapons? Were you armed?
Oh yeah. I had my pistol with me. So I sent my wife down and I said, you're not going to believe this, but our guard, he welched on a bet. So they were carrying him off to tune him up to get their money back.
And did he come back to work? I know what happened because I read it in the book.
Yeah, he did. He came back, but too embarrassed to say anything about it.
You mentioned that, Murph, we forgot to start off. You forgot to do your proper intro. Tell everybody about the book.
That's right. So there's a book out called Unpopular Causes, A Career in Service to America by Charles Harry Lutz, and that's our guest today. I've read through the book. It's exciting. It shows you a patriot who dedicated his entire professional life to serving his fellow man here in the United States, doing his best to protect our country, not only in the military, but then in DEA. And it didn't stop there, but I don't want to get too far ahead of the story because we want to talk about your careers, plural, after DEA.
Yeah, we'll get into that. So while you were there in Cairo, Did you go out and take advantage of the local sites? Did you go out and visit the pyramids, you know, go visit the place where Giza cotton is made, you know, at the mouth of the Nile, any of that good stuff?
Yeah, we did, took advantage of it. We didn't, go on an African safari because we honestly couldn't afford it. Around Egypt, we went I forget the name of the place where they, from World War II, they have a German and a British cemetery.
Is that over in Tunisia or?
No. In Egypt.
Oh, in Egypt. Okay.
Yeah. And I took my family to Cyprus for a vacation. And it wasn't all work. Most of it was work, but not all of it.
So in Egypt, what was your focus there?
Well, that's how I ended up with a regional responsibility. When I applied for the job, in fact, we'd only been back from Bangkok 1 year. I was in international training at the time. I'm sorry, domestic training at the time. And I should go back and tell you that in Bangkok, I was very fortunate. I had a couple of cases that got recognition, Attorney General's Award, presidential citation, that sort of thing. So the administrator, Peter Benzinger, knew who I was. And I saw this advertisement and I just missed out in Bangkok in getting promoted to a supervisory position. And so I saw this ad for the agent in charge in Cairo, and I didn't realize at the time that the agent there had been basically restricted to Egypt. The ambassador didn't want him there, didn't want a DEA office, and convinced as I put it in my book, Benzinger diplomatically shoved the DEA office down the ambassador's throat, and the ambassador, his one demand was that if there's not enough for him to do in Egypt, then he didn't belong there. So they agreed he would just stay there. Well, I got there, and there was nothing to do. Egypt is a drug-consuming country. Methamphetamine was a problem. It had been introduced by the British to the workers of the Aswan Dam, so that was a huge problem. And they also produced some opium, but it was all consumed domestically. The big drug of abuse was hashish, and that all came from Lebanon and was consumed, of course, in Egypt. So there's really nothing to do other than, some hash cases of boats bringing in, or camels, bringing in hashish. And I didn't want to spend 2 years of my life doing that.
I just made a bus today. We took a camel down with 4 kilos of hash on it.
So, I mean, being overseas to me meant protecting our own country. We were working with these nations, law enforcement authorities, helping them to help us. And of course, that was just simply not the case in Egypt. So I got an opportunity early on to go to a conference in Paris, and I convinced my boss there to give me some responsibility. When Beirut fell, they closed the Beirut office because an agent had been kidnapped under the presumption he was a CIA case officer. They finally released him, but DEA thought it was just simply too dangerous to maintain DEA agents there. And they were not, obviously, it was in the middle of a war, so they weren't accomplishing much. And so they closed the office. Well, when they did, they gave all of the Middle East to Turkey. Well, Terry Dunn was the attaché there. Turkey was a huge source of opium. And I convinced the bosses there. I said, this is crazy, to have Turkey responsible for all these other countries. They got enough to do in Turkey. So they said, well, you can't leave Cairo. And I said, well, that we have a new ambassador. Let me give it a try. He may not know anything about it. So they said, okay. So they gave me, I'm a one-man office, right? The only one in DEA at the time. They gave me not only Lebanon, Cyprus, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and all of East Africa. I mean, I'm one guy.
Be careful what you ask for.
Yeah, exactly. But it worked out fine. I was able to lay the groundwork for an eventual office in Nicosia. And as I said before, I spent most of my time in Beirut. I did get one trip into Africa to the Sudan.
Well, I'll tell you, you were speaking of that too. That reminded me too. I had to look up, just check the dates. But Beirut was a bad place. You talked about they thought he was a case officer. They actually ended up kidnapping the chief of station in Beirut in 1984, William F. Buckley. He was in captivity for 14 months and died in captivity in 1980. It was a dangerous, that was, like you say, that was one dangerous place.
Well, the ambassador there gave me an office within the embassy, and I guess it was within a year of my leaving Cairo, transferring back to the States, that the embassy was blown up, and it was actually on that side of the building where my office was. But, I remember when I used to go over there, the regional security officer would loan me a pistol. But he said, if you're walking down the street and somebody bumps into you, say, excuse me, and keep walking, because I'll guarantee you they're better armed than you are with your little 38 pistol.
I got to tell you, one of the funniest things I saw, and it speaks to why, not one of the, well, funny in a different way, but everybody's got their own sense of humor based on where they are, like culturally. And there was shit being blown up, still stuff happening in Egypt. But one of the prank shows they did, they showed this guy, it was in Cairo. He's there and there's people there. He walks up with a briefcase and sets it down and looks at him and starts running away, basically saying it's a bomb and watching everybody react to it. And I'm going, good Lord, you guys think that's funny over there? And for some reason, they thought that was hilarious to make people believe there was a bomb in a suitcase.
Yeah.
And it was like candid camera, except candid boom, you know?
That's not smart.
Well, if I may, we kind of skipped over Thailand in terms of the cases over there. I don't know.
No, let's talk about that.
Go back to that or not?
Yeah. Let's. Yeah. Well, you talked. I mean, you kind of sandbagged us there. You said, "Well, I got the presidential citation and the AG." Let's talk about that case then. I hit the wrong. I don't know. I hit something on my keyboard and it was like, "Oh, there we go." I'll have to edit that out. Boom, boom. Thank you very much. I'll be here all week.
Try the wheel.
Well, as I said before, there are so many cases, it's just hard to pick out a few, but there were two in particular. One, I finally was able to work undercover successfully on a heroin case. It was actually early on in my tour duty there when I was introduced to an informant who was able to introduce me undercover to the fellow who, according to DEA documents, had actually been the first person to ever create Asian heroin, white Asian heroin, China white, and a guy named Sukri Sukripuram. And I was actually... I worked undercover with Matty Marr, who you may know, and we ended up we seized 25 kilograms of heroin. Actually, it was it wasn't China white; it was the smoking heroin. But 25 pounds of it was a lot of heroin, needless to say. And we arrested Sukri and also his partner in crime, a guy named Hoi Se Wan, who had put a threat out on agents who had seized, I think, 90 some kilograms of his heroin in Southern California. So that was quite a case. We were very fortunate in that there was a heroin conference going on with some people from the White House, and Matty and I were asked to go and brief them on this case that had just been taken down. And so they went back and wrote letters to Matty and I, signed by Gerald Ford. So that was I was able to prove to my Philadelphia colleagues that I had finally made a heroin case.
Hey, real quickly, you mentioned something interesting. You said he was the first guy to come up to turn this in, you know, this China white. Was he a chemist, or was he more of a businessman that knew how to get the chemists to do the stuff?
He was a chemist by training. He owned a company that was called Analabs that actually would test commodities for its purity and so forth. A shipload of molasses, they would go and they would test it to make sure that what was in the cargo hold was molasses, was pure, and what it weighed and so on before someone would buy it. And but he was a chemist, and he looked more like a pharmacist to me than a heroin dealer, but he was big time. And speaking of corruption, a couple of months after he was arrested, they let him go. He fled, and we never found him. Hoi Se Wan was actually a Malaysian. He didn't have any connections there in Thailand, so he probably died in prison. But Sukri got away. Of course, we never heard from him again. So maybe he never went back into the heroin business. I don't know.
Did you ever get any chatter that he was still alive, you know, anywhere?
Well, we looked for him. I had information he was actually had fled to Oranje Pertet, which is a town on the Cambodian border in Thailand. And so I actually wanted investigative assistance, and I went up there and spent a couple of days, had a picture of Sukri, and checked out all the bars and massage parlors and whatever, see if we could find them. And we never did.
Hey, players, that is the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, go check us out at Game of Crimes on Twitter, at Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also, go check out our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including our book list. Any book written by our guests will be listed there. In the meantime, go check us out also, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. It's where we put a lot more content you won't hear on our regular podcast. We go into a lot more topics, and folks, it is a lot of fun. So go check us out, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. In the meantime, everybody stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.